Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
And I'm Mike Mulcahy from the Capitol today. Education, healthcare, jobs, public safety, all issues up for debate at the state capitol for the next 14 weeks or so. It's day four of the 2020 legislative session. We're broadcasting from the Capitol today to get a sense of where some of these issues may end up, or at least where the debate will start. The legislature is still divided. Democrats control the House, Republicans control the Senate. So a big question is how much will get done and how many of these debates will continue right up to the November election when all the seats in the House and Senate are up for grabs. Joining me here in our state capitol bureau are the Speaker of the Minnesota House, DFL Representative Melissa Hortman of Brooklyn Park, and Republican State Senator John Jasinski of Faribault. He's an assistant majority leader in the Senate. You can get your question in for these leaders if you want. Give us a call, 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000 is the number to call. Speaker Hortman, Senator Jasinski, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
And Madam Speaker, let me start with you. House Democrats yesterday proposed spending a chunk of that $1.3 billion projected surplus on child care to help both families and daycare providers. Why does the state need to do that?
Well, that proposal reflects that children are our highest priority, especially when they're 0 to age 3. We know that that portion of their life is the most critical for brain development. We have really good research coming out of Minnesota. Art Rolnick's group put out a study back in 2003, and we have seen other states around the country operationalize Art Rolnick's findings. But here in Minnesota, we're still not to the point where we have high-quality early education opportunities for all those children who are looking for that. So when we have a $1.3 billion surplus and we think about where to spend it, I think our children 0 to 3 are our highest priority.
Senator Jasinski, is that on the list of priorities for the state Senate this year?
I would say that's not on the list of priorities. We obviously did a budget in 2019, which funded government for the next 2 years. So we believe that was about a $50 billion budget. So we believe that's a full funding for the next cycle. Our more priorities are some tax relief. With a $1.3 billion surplus, we've obviously taxed people too much. So we'd like to get some tax relief back, mainly the Social Security exemption to fully exempt Social Security tax, and then also possibly the 179 exemption for business owners and farmers.
I think it's important to point out I reject the fundamental premise of what the Minnesota Republican Senate is saying about last year's budget. We did enact a budget. It was not full funding for the things that we know that we need to do. We did not adequately invest in education. We had a compromise in order to get a budget. But in the places where we were admittedly inadequate last year, because Senate Republicans were unwilling to invest as much as we need to in our littlest learners, it's time for us to address that lack of funding that we allowed to exist last year.
Well, can I just ask, with this $1.3 billion surplus, you can say it's overtaxed, you can say the economy's doing really well, but is it one-time money, and does it make sense to spend one-time money on what would be an ongoing expense, presumably with childcare?
Well, with childcare, there is some question there about how much of the surplus can we use and for what purposes. And in general, that's right. We should not use one-time surplus money to make ongoing commitments. What you hear the Senate talking about with a proposed tax cut of around with a price tag of around $400 million going into forever and growing in the out years substantially, That's not a responsible proposal. When we're looking at a $1.3 billion surplus, what we can say is that you're only three once. You are only four once. And so if we are able to create more preschool slots this year for three-year-olds or four-year-olds, even if we have to say to next year's three-year-olds and four-year-olds and their families, we don't have the money this year to continue funding for that program, we have made a difference in the life of that child for the rest of their life. And I think we have to balance the investment in those children against having reserves that are in excess of what we need to prepare for the next downturn.
Senator, I think I heard the speaker say that your tax cut for Social Security earners is too expensive.
That's what it sounded like to me. But again, that's the biggest thing we're hearing out there from our constituents is they want to get that Social Security tax eliminated. And it's priorities. I get both House and the Senate. We have our different priorities, and we'll work together to try and come up with something to compromise. Also on the $1.3 billion is possibly looking at something that to use that for infrastructure instead of borrowing as much. We can save some monies by not borrowing as much for infrastructure. And I think the House and the Senate both agree we need to invest in our infrastructure. It's the dollar amount that kind of sometimes gets, you know, where you have to negotiate that. Or the projects. But I think most both the Senate and the House, infrastructure in wastewater treatment facilities, roads and bridges, and our HEPA money for our colleges are our top three priorities, at least in the Senate. And I'll let the Speaker talk on hers. But I think that's what I've been hearing from everybody is that those are the big three items that we should be putting our money into.
Can I get to that in just a second? But let me ask you, Madam Speaker, about the Social Security tax cut or any tax cut, really. Is the House just not in a mood to do that this year?
Well, I think our tax chair put it the best when he said that there's probably not a single person in the Minnesota legislature who doesn't want to eliminate that tax on Social Security. But what you have to look at is what we have already done in that area and where we are in taxes. And Minnesota has a very progressive tax code. So we tax those who are at the lower end of the income spectrum the least, and we tax those who are at the highest end of the income spectrum the most. So the vast majority of people who receive Social Security income in the state of Minnesota are not paying taxes on that income because people in their senior years, generally speaking, their income is lower. And so for the vast majority of people who need a tax cut, we delivered that last year. We delivered a substantial middle class tax cut last year. And then for those at the lowest end of the income spectrum, we already exempt all that income from taxation. So when we look at priorities of what we should do looking forward for the state of Minnesota, we have to look at the opportunity cost of each of our investments. And if we use one-time money and spend it on a three-year-old this year, the dividends that we get for the rest of that person's life will inure to the benefit of the state. If we instead take that money and we spend it on a wastewater treatment plant, when we could bond for 1.44% interest and still have the wastewater treatment plant and invest in the three-year-old, we have to look at what is the cost-benefit analysis for the state and how we spend our money, looking not just at this year, but 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and 40 years into the future.
That's DFL House Speaker Melissa Hortman. She is from Brooklyn Park. We're also joined today by Senator John Jasinski from Faribault. He's an assistant majority leader in the Senate. And I think you're getting some sense already about some of the trade-offs the legislature has to deal with when it approaches some of these big issues. If you have a question for these leaders, give us a call. 651-227-6000 is the number. 651-227-6000. And Senator, you brought up the bonding bill, is what they call it. It's the public works construction plan, usually done with bonds. Mm-hmm. The governor's proposed $2 billion, more than $2 billion in projects to invest in over the next year or so, or 2 years. What do you think of that amount?
Honestly, you know, I've been thinking about that, listening. I was on the bonding committee. We've toured the state, and there's a lot of great projects out there. There's no doubt there's money needed across the state to take care of some of these projects we have and the capital investment. My concern, and I come from a construction background, and when you drive around the summer months, you see all the work that's going on out there. They're hurting for staff. They have a lot of work. If, you know, we've been doing about $1 billion for the last couple of years since I've been in the Senate. If you influx double that amount, what from a contractor standpoint is if they have so much work, they bid high. Okay, if they bid high, it's costing the Minnesota taxpayers more money because they're just raising their prices because they can't handle that work. They can't find the workforce. There's only so many contractors out there. So I believe that that really costs the state more money if we're putting too much money in at one time, keeping it steady kind of holds that bar where the contractors can handle the work and things like that. So I really believe that we spend too much when we influx too much money at once because these contractors can just not handle it, and they put their prices high. Trust me, I've been in a bid room. I see how it's bid. If those contractors are full, they bid higher price, and if they get it, they get it. And it costs us more. If they're hungry for work, they bid lower and they're more aggressive, and we as taxpayers in Minnesota save money by that.
Well, are you saying the Senate is more comfortable with $1 billion than $2 billion?
From listening to my members, yes, we're more in that $1 billion range. We like to stick around there. Some of our caucus are under $1 billion, some of them are over $1 billion, but I think we're pretty comfortable around the level we've been doing for the last couple of years. Again, for the reason I stated earlier, is we can't influx too much money at once. There's just not the contractors out there that can handle the work.
Madam Speaker, what do you think? $2 billion too high?
Well, the needs are extensive across the state, and I think we have to give more faith and confidence in our city and county leaders that the projects that they're bringing forward are projects that are actually needed. Listening to the testimony in the Capital Investment Committee on the first day of session, Representative Dwayne Suk from Rochester made a really important point. There are these communities with these wastewater treatment plants that are on the verge of collapse, literally on the verge of collapse, and they are hoping that they have said the right magic words when Minnesota legislators happen to stop in their community. And it's kind of like roulette. I just think we have to trust that our local leaders are bringing forward needs that are true needs. They're not frivolous. And my understanding from the bonding tours is that as people have seen these wastewater treatment infrastructure needs and local roads and bridges, that the needs are obvious. So we have to worry about underinvesting. There is a balance that we have to strike. Of course, we should not take on debt that would be irresponsible, because bonding houses don't like to see a state with too much debt. Then our interest rate that we would pay on that debt would be higher. But they also look at, is the state taking care of its assets? And so we have considerable amount of assets that haven't had enough maintenance over the years. We are really nearing a crisis point. You know, the civil engineers in the country have given Minnesota a D on the quality of our infrastructure. At a time when we can borrow money for very low interest rates and the construction cost index is higher than the rate of interest, we really should be taking this opportunity to invest. And I have not heard our contracting community say that they don't have enough workers to do these jobs. There's nothing wrong with Minnesota getting to full employment.
And about this notion of using some of the surplus cash to spend directly on construction projects, you're not interested in that?
Well, I think we have to ask ourselves, what is the best return on the investment for Minnesotans? So if we buy, if we pay cash for improvements in a wastewater treatment plant, when we could instead be paying, 1.44% interest, I know some of the bonds were let with incredible interest rates in the last year. And we say to families of the three-year-olds, I'm sorry we don't have any money to assist you with your childcare this year. I'm sorry we don't have any money to assist you in getting your three-year-old the high-quality learning experience that we know is in his or her best interests. I'm not sure that is the right choice to make for the taxpayers of Minnesota. I think we can do both this year. We can have responsible debt and take care of our wastewater infrastructure, but we do have a cash surplus that we can choose to invest in human beings.
All right, let's take a call. Jan is on the line in St. Paul. Hi, Jan, go ahead.
Hi, I am a transit rider. Since I moved to St. Paul 17 years ago, I ride transit because I don't drive. You don't want me to drive, trust me. I'm legally blind. There have been a lot of stuff in the Star Tribune recently about the transit shifting dollars here and there to try and cover the safety issue. If you think mm-hmm. about it, Metro Transit has to cover all or part of 7 counties. Each one of those counties has a sheriff and a corps of deputies, but the transit police have to cover that whole vast area. And I have ridden many, many, many rides where I start out, I live on the far east side of St. Paul, and I want to go to Edina, I want to go to Rosedale, I want to go someplace, I want to go to Orchestra Hall, and it usually takes 3 buses or 2 buses and a train to get where I want to go. I can do that and never, never see a transit police person. Some of the behavior I see, especially on the train, is so appalling. And I have spoken to people like putting your feet on the seats and little things mm-hmm. like that. And they tell me, don't tell me what to do. I've seen people doing chin-ups on the strap hangers on the train, you know, 17 to 14-year-old kids.
Let me ask our guests about that. Transit security, especially on the light rail lines. Senator, what's the thinking in the Senate about what to do about that issue?
Well, I believe I just heard a statement from Charlie Zelli, who said they're going to put more officers on those light rail. And
he's the Met Council chair.
New Met Council chair, I should say, yes. So I think that's good to do that and get some money out there. Because, again, people, if we have that infrastructure that we've invested over the years, we should make sure it's safe. And that's on a rise, not only in Metro Transit, but across the metro area, off the transit as well. So that's a concern we would look into. And we definitely want to make the streets safe for people. I heard of an instance, I was at a meeting the other day, and I think it was the city of Minneapolis proposed 400 new police officers to make the metro more safe. And I think city council or who it was came up and said they approved 14. So that's just a huge number shift of where the numbers are looking at. But we definitely would like to see more safe public safety in the area to keep people safe.
What about this notion of reducing the fine for riding the train without a ticket? Do you support that?
Well, I have mixed feelings about that. I think they're not actually prosecuting those tickets because the judges seem to be throwing those out. So to do that, and if they could administratively come up with a way to collect those fees better to make it more money going into that, I think, you know, we have to look at that. I don't know the answer right now, but I've seen both sides. So it does make sense because if these tickets are not being prosecuted, from what I understand, a judge doesn't want to do that to make it I believe it's a felony and they don't want to do that. So for a $2 fine just doesn't make sense. And I look at the other way, and if we just have it done within, is that correct as well? So what type of message is that sending? So I'm not sure yet, but I definitely think we need to look into it, a way to come up with a happy medium.
Speaker Hortman, what do you think about that issue?
Well, unfortunately, transit funding is one of those things that's been an ideological divide in Minnesota and was literally the last thing funded in the budget agreement. And we provided funding for Metropolitan Transit only if the state exceeded its collection. So it was only out of projected surplus funds that they're even getting their ordinary allocation. And so when people talk about their desire to invest in public safety, but then don't put the dollars there to do that, one questions the commitment really to public safety, because you can't do it for free. It costs money to pay the officers to be out there. And so I think, you know, this is one area where you'll see a big difference through this session and then going into the summer and the fall with Democrats and Republicans in the suburbs really committed to transit, Democrats in particular. And you will have suburban voters saying to Republican candidates, you know, if you aren't willing to invest in transit, I'm not sure you're the candidate for me. We have had nearly a decade of underinvestment in Minnesota's transit system, and we're starting to see that fraying of that social fabric in our transit system. With Republican control, you know, bouncing around over the last 8 years under Governor Dayton, there were just significant periods where we weren't putting what we needed into the system. And you see the riders are noticing the quality reducing. And so I'm happy that Chair Zelli is committed to fixing the problem, but we have to give him the resources to do that.
Is that going to happen this year, or will that wait till the next budget session?
That will definitely be a conversation point. I think there is a shared interest in doing something on the quality of service on our transit system.
All right. Let's take another call. Catherine on the line from Minneapolis. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. There is a federal grant of $6.6 million to improve our elections, specifically security. And I keep having these nightmares that Minnesota can't be another Iowa in all the snafus that happened after the Iowa caucuses. So my question to the Senate person is, why is the Senate holding up approval of this money? Because in my opinion, this is federal money. The state shouldn't have their hands on any of the approvals or anything to flow to the Secretary of State's office. And it should just go rightly there, because the counties need a huge lead time to get the appropriate security measures in place. So I'd like to have the explanation from the Senate person. Thanks.
Senator, I thought that money was approved.
That money was approved. It didn't get done until later in the year. I believe our Senator Kiffmeyer, the chair of the State Government Committee, wanted to make sure that money was going to be spent wisely, and wanted to make sure there were some checks and balances.
I think the caller's talking about a new allocation. There's a new allocation of $7.4 million this year.
But last year, we had one as well that was held back towards the end for the HAVA money that we did approve in the end, but we held off a little bit longer to make sure that we knew where that money was going to be spent.
Well,
so I have a feeling it's the same movie, same ending, which is we will fight all session to get Senator Kiffmeyer to release the money. It would be nice to get it out sooner so that our counties could actually use it in this election cycle. Doesn't that seem like a good idea, Senator Jasinski?
It may. We'll look into that this session, and we'll go through those negotiations.
Well, let me ask another question about elections, and that is the data privacy in this primary, which is coming up, the presidential primary, March 3rd. You have to say which party ballot you take, and that information goes to the parties, and then presumably they can do whatever they want with it, and a lot of people aren't happy with that. Speaker, what's going to happen?
Well, I think it's really important to look at the origin story for how did we get here, and how we got here was in 2008 and in 2016, each of the parties had a straw poll at their precinct caucuses. So you take a cold Tuesday night, probably between the hours of 7 and 9 or 10 p.m., and we had hundreds, if not thousands, of people standing outside of high schools and elementary schools and churches waiting to get into their precinct caucus to cast a ballot in the straw poll. So Minnesotans said to us after that, please do something different. We know this is a party nominating contest. I'm a Democrat. I go to Democratic precinct caucuses. But why do I have to stand outside for 2 hours to say whether I'm for Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton in 2016? And so voters said to us, please use the state's electoral apparatus. Give us the whole day. Use the machines. Make it something that we know we're not writing on paper towels in the bathroom when we run out of yellow slips at our precinct caucus. So we are now using the state's election apparatus, but it is still for a party process. And the reason why we're using the state's election apparatus for what is a party process is for the ease and convenience of Minnesota voters. So just like when you go to a Republican precinct caucus, you don't want and have a throng of Democrats going there to disrupt their process of choosing their nominee. So that's why we are where we are with regard to the data. I think that there was a misinterpretation of the deal. The deal was supposed to be Democrats get data about Democrats, Republicans get data about Republicans, and the pot parties get data about whoever participates in their primaries. But there was, because of a misinterpretation, we're now stuck with a state law that says Republicans get everybody's data, Democrats get everybody's data, and the pot parties get everybody's data. If we could fix it and get back to the deal that we all agreed to, I think that would be fantastic. Or go even further and let people opt out of having their information disclosed. But I think it's really important to understand how we got where we got. Mm-hmm.
But that's basically what the Secretary of State has proposed, right? And the bill moved in the House committee yesterday. Senator, is that likely to move through the Senate, something like that?
Excuse me. And that came before I was here, 2016. So I understand the speaker did a great job explaining the way I understand it came about. But I think we'll look at it. I don't know if we can change that this year, what we'll do if we have the time to do that. But I think obviously we'll have time before the next 4 years before we do that again to possibly look at re-looking at that and see if we can changing that. But I know the parties they wanted their data, and looking at somehow to make sure it goes just to the party and doesn't go anywhere else is what they're looking at to try and make a reasonable medium compromise. Compromise. So we'll see how that goes through.
But you don't think there's time to do it yet this year?
Well, they're coming up awfully quick, I believe.
There is absolutely time. But if you're a Republican chair of state government in the Senate and your candidate and your party is really not having a primary and you want to get hold of the Democrats' data, there's real incentive not to do anything. So we've had a little frustration. You know, I really like Mary Kiffmeyer. We're good friends, but I think she's wrong on the speed with which she'll let money go to the Secretary of State and the county elections officials. And I think she's wrong about voter privacy and not letting it be more protected than it is right now.
Senator, are you getting any pressure on this from people?
I have not received one call or one email from any of my constituents on this item. I've been to a couple forums where I've heard some discussion on it. I've had talked about it on radio in Faribault and KDHL, and they brought it up, obviously, like this, but I have not had any calls or any constituent requests of concern with it.
It is a top issue. When we look at our metrics of who's writing in on which topics, it is a top concern in Minnesota right now.
All right. Let's take another caller, Joe, in Leonard, Minnesota. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. How are you doing? It's a balmy 10 below up here. Yes,
oh, beautiful.
Mrs. Hortman made two key words, crisis and assets. I'm a clerk up here, basically Clearwater County and Beltrami County lost 850 individual residents because of excess property taxes. They could not afford to pay them. I'm on a fixed income. My taxes have gone up 920% in the last 4 years. Half my income is mandated for taxes and insurance and whatnot. It's basically unsustainable. Your biggest asset in this state is the taxpayers. Government shouldn't be the second highest employer in the state. I am liquidating everything, and I'm moving to Wyoming because they're very, very tax-friendly. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Property taxes too high in rural Minnesota.
Definitely. You know, what Democrats believe is that your property taxes should have some relationship to what you can afford to pay. The property tax is the most unfair tax that we have. And that's why we are big proponents of the property tax refund programs that allow people a refund on their property taxes depending upon their income and their age. So we have some good programs that we have fought hard for over the years. The property tax doesn't care how much money you made last year. The property tax is what it is. And that's why we should try to shift as much as we can off of the property tax and onto the state general fund. The reason for that is the state general fund, as we talked about before, relies on progressive taxation. So people at the lowest end of the income spectrum pay a proportion of their income, and people at the higher end pay more in aggregate dollars, but a smaller percent of their income. And people can deal with the income tax because it has some relationship to their ability to pay. But the property tax is a really tough tax for families, especially for seniors. And so that's why we have really fought to shift things like school funding to be more substantially funded by state revenues.
Senator, what do you think's going on with property taxes out there?
Well, they are high. And, you know, I was a mayor for 8 years, and that was the number one thing. You come in when you have your taxation meetings, and they come in and they complain about their taxes. And a lot of times that's due to valuation because the market was going up, or if it's going down, it sometimes takes a long time to catch up because the way they assess values versus what the market value is, sometimes there's a couple years delay. But overall, generally, I do agree with the gentleman coming in. We're losing a lot of Minnesota residents that are leaving the state, not only in property taxes, sales tax, income tax, estate tax. I have several people that are in my district that live in Florida half the year because they don't want to pay the taxes here. And I think we're losing a lot of value to our state for those people that are going down there who used to maybe volunteer at a senior center or something like that, who are exiting out of here because our taxes are high. So the Republican caucus in the Senate is trying to keep those taxes down. We're the ones that initiated the second-tier income tax reduction. So we're trying to get that and trying to reduce taxes in Minnesota. So I fully sympathize for the gentleman who called in, and we need to make sure that our taxes are lower here in Minnesota in all aspects. So we would continue to do that.
Well, the facts just don't bear out that people are leaving Minnesota due to taxes. In fact, the other is true. Minnesota is the only Midwestern state that's growing now. When you look at states like South Dakota and even Iowa and Wisconsin and compare it to Minnesota, we have a better quality of life. We have a higher income per capita. We have higher educational achievement. And people know that you get what you pay for. This is why, in part, communities that have a reputation of having great schools, people are willing to pay more for their house and more for their property taxes to live in those communities. Communities like Edina, Minnetonka, Hopkins, people are willing to pay more for the same house that they could get cheaper somewhere else because they want that quality. The same is true with the state of Minnesota. People choose to live here because they know we have Fortune 500 companies, we have great employment prospects, and we have a robust civic and arts community. So I think you absolutely get what you pay for. The data does not bear out that people are leaving Minnesota due to the tax climate. I will foresee retiring someday in Phoenix or, you know, Naples, Florida or something, but it's because it's warm there and really not about taxes.
I kind of thought about that this morning. But our guests, Melissa Hortman, the DFL Speaker of the Minnesota House, and Republican Assistant Majority Leader in the Senate, John Jasinski. If you have a question, give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. You know, another story that's been in the news quite a bit is the Department of Human Services. It's a department that deals with huge amounts of money, trying to help large numbers of people. But it's been sort of a drip, drip, drip of news, mistakes, loose oversight, problem spending, adding up to, you know, millions and millions of dollars. Speaker Hortman, some people have suggested breaking up the department, that it's too big, that it could be better if it concentrated in a few areas with different agencies. What do you think about that?
Well, it's my understanding that each of the four leaders have had a one-on-one conversation with the governor about this, and that we're all kind of on the same page, which is we don't want to do something that's ultimately counterproductive. Whether it's Chair Benson in the Senate or the majority leader in the Senate, Gazelka, or me, we'd like to look very carefully at how we could change DHS to work better. But just breaking it into pieces doesn't fix accountability problems. I think we have to remember two things about DHS. The vast majority of the work that DHS does is of incredibly high quality and exactly as Minnesotans would intend. We have a number of folks who work in assisted living facilities who are taking care of people. And the money that Minnesotans pay in taxes to serve people with disabilities and to serve the elderly and the ill, that money is by and large being spent well to take care of people. Now, in those cases where it's not being spent well, I think we are all very, very committed to figuring out how to get that number to the absolute smallest we can. Breaking the agency into pieces may help us do that, but it may not. So I think there's a lot of consensus around taking the time to take a serious look at it before we start moving things around.
Senator, what do you think?
I would agree with the speaker. I think we can't have a knee-jerk reaction to what's going on. We need to look at a big picture and see what we can do. But that's the number one thing I hear in my district. They're very concerned about the waste, the fraud, and the abuse. And I'm all for giving some assistance in those things, but we need to make sure we're giving the right people the right money, or assistance, I should say, to make sure it's done. And I'll applaud Governor Walz. He did it with Minlars. I was involved with that very much, and he dug in deep to make sure that was corrected, and he wanted to get that done. And I hope and I think you will continue that work on DHS to make sure that that is done there as well. But it's a much bigger thing and many more complicated features of the system. So, but I hope he will continue on with that and make sure that we look into it because it's a huge dollar amount that's going out from our state.
So nothing big, major likely to happen this year, it sounds like.
Right. We're all anxious to take action right away, but we're all also cognizant of taking action that's ultimately counterproductive. So we'll be balancing those two concerns through the session.
Senator, you mentioned Minlars. I know you were in a hearing this morning about Real ID, which
correct,
everybody has to get by October to fly on a domestic flight, basically. How do things stand with that?
Well, I believe through the different scenarios they have now with Real ID and having passports, they believe there's about 50% of the Minnesotans are ready to go for that. But if you do the calculations between now and October 1st, to get the rest of the people done is going to be a huge task. So they're encouraging everybody to get in by June 1st to get that done. That's a big thing to get done before June 1st. But I also believe there's a lot of people that may not, you know, have to have it by October 1st. They may not travel. They have a driver's license now and a passport, and they can get by. But we definitely want to encourage them to get in and be sympathetic to the deputy registers. They're handling a lot of information. There's a lot of things that are required. It's complicated. There's certain requirements on the forms you have to bring in. And unfortunately, these deputy registers get paid $1 a month for that. And right now, it's $8. And they have to bring all this information in. And if they get halfway through a transaction and they don't have the right information, they don't get paid anything. So we need to make sure we educate the public on what they need to bring in, work with them, and when they do come in, be sympathetic to these deputy registers because they're trying their best to get it done. But look into go online. There's a website online that you can see all the information, what you need to do, and all the things I just put out on a Facebook post on my post today. It's got some great graphics of what you need, when you need to get it done, and what will be required. So I think we're going along the right lines. I think we have a lot of people, both on the House and the Democrats. It's a nonpartisan issue. We need to get this done for our Minnesotans, and I think we'll reach an agreement that will continue to make sure we go ahead.
My husband is my test case, so he tried to go a couple months ago to start this process, and he didn't bring all the right pieces of paper. So when we renewed our tabs, when we got the mailing from DVS, it had a list in there of all the things. And so he went this morning, and it took him 1 hour, and they said that he will get his real ID before June. So the clock is ticking here. February 14th, the Hortman household applied for a real ID. We'll see how long it takes to get it.
Wow. Okay. Well, we'll check back with you on that. I wanted to ask a question about guns. There was a debate, at least in the House last year, about these what they call red flag laws and about expanding background checks. The Senate didn't hold hearings on that. Is anything likely to happen on that issue this year? Senator, let me start with you.
Well, we had some informational hearings. Actually, we had one in St. Paul and one up in Hibbing. And
Over
the interim, correct, to get some information and things out there. The one in Hibbing was got pretty interesting up there if you watched it. And the one in St. Paul gave a lot of information out because I think Minnesota does have some stringent gun laws. I think we're the 10th most complicated gun laws in the nation. So educating those people on what exists right now. And then with some of the red flag bills, we're not happy with those because the due process comes out of there. So I know there's some concern. I know Senator Limmer has been highly attuned to what's going on, and I don't know what will happen in this session yet. I have not talked to him about it yet, where we'll go with that.
Speaker.
Well, today is the second anniversary of the shooting in Parkland, and that really was a shooting that changed everything. There were so many shootings before that you would have thought would have changed everything. Columbine, Sandy Hook, Aurora, whether you're in a church, a community college, a school, a movie theater. We have had an epidemic of gun violence in the United States of America, and people are saying to us, we know you can't do everything. We know you can't prevent every senseless act of violence, but you can do something. And in states with Republican governors, Republican houses, and Republican senates, they have enacted these two common sense provisions. We are not asking for a lot in the House. We have two proposals. One is universal background checks, and the other is a red flag law. And the reason we are asking for these two is they have in excess of 70% Gallup approval rating. This is what the public is asking us for. And in the states where they have been enacted, they have reduced deaths by gun. And so we know the red flag law in particular has a dramatic impact on suicides. Right now, there is no tool for law enforcement in the state of Minnesota if it is very clear that an individual has articulated a threat to harm themselves or to harm other people. Law enforcement cannot come in and take the firearms out of that situation. There is due process in our bill. The way that the bill is structured, it would have to be a law enforcement official, city attorney, county attorney, police officer, or sheriff who goes to court and says, I have actionable intelligence that this individual is a threat to him or herself or to other people. And there's a hearing, and there is notice, there is an opportunity to be heard. Just like in a domestic violence case now, we have the possibility of ex parte hearings, but there is due process that withstands constitutional scrutiny. So we have no interest in having any kind of a process that doesn't provide due process for the people of the state of Minnesota. We take an oath to uphold the United States Constitution, and I take seriously both the Second and the 14th Amendments. But these proposals have been shown to save lives, and we should do it for Minnesotans here.
And I'm sure you know that some rural counties in the state are talking about becoming what they call Second Amendment sanctuary counties, where some of these laws wouldn't apply, presumably. What do you think about that?
Well, I haven't heard that anything like that is close to becoming reality, but it doesn't sound like something that's within the realm of the county or city government to disclaim state law.
Senator?
I would echo that. I don't think that should be done. I don't think it will happen. They've obviously talking. There's been some hubbub about it, but I don't think you'll be seeing that happen.
So how much of this session is going to be about getting things done, and how much of it is going to be about these kind of debates that carry through to the election and looking forward to November?
Well, I think that we have plenty to run against each other about, right? There's different fundamental philosophies of Republicans and Democrats. And I think you will see some of the session dedicated to each of us articulating our vision for the state of Minnesota. The Republicans in the Senate will pass some bills that would show what they would do if there was a Republican House. And Democrats in the House, we will pass proposals like paid family medical leave, and the gun violence prevention measures and climate action that show what we would do if we had a democratically led Senate. But we're really focused also on those areas where we can come together and agree. And I think it's important not to dismiss the articulation of our visions as just politics, because we live in a democracy, so we all get to decide. Politics is how we make decisions in a democracy. And it's important that we say very clearly to voters what it is that we would do if we're in the driver's seat. But aside from articulating our vision that the voters can act on in November, we'll be talking about what to do with that $1.3 billion surplus and how to best invest it for Minnesotans. And we'll look at the state's long-term investments in the bonding bill.
Senator, I'll give you the last word.
Well, thank you. And it's my first time going into an election. Obviously, this is going into my fourth year, so I haven't been through this before. But I agree with the Speaker that we need to get some important things done and make our messages out there, what we feel is important. But we can't miss the important things. There's the insulin issue, the bonding, the $1.3 billion surplus. We want to get those things done. There's other items that come up that we want to get done that we can do. And we all have to stick to our core values, I think. I stick to my core values and my constituents, and I know the Speaker does as well with hers, and we have to make our messages out there and let the voters decide of who they think is doing best and what our values are, and we'll get there. But I'm fortunate. I believe we'll have a good the tone is already good. I know Senator Gazelka is one of my favorite things being under him in the Senate, as he has a very good tone. I think I get along very good with the governor. I have a good relationship with him. The Speaker and I don't know each other that well, but every time we've gotten along or been together, we get along. So I think that's very important to set that tone to get things done for Minnesotans.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on you and see how it goes. Thanks so much for being here. That's Republican State Senator John Jasinski and DFL House Speaker Melissa Hortman.
Support for this program comes from the Original Mattress Factory, hosting a Maplewood factory tour and open house where you and your family can see how each of our mattresses are hand-built this Saturday from 10 till 5. The Original Mattress Factory. Support comes from Solar Pod Crown, Minnesota-owned since 2009, offering patented rooftop solar systems that don't require any roof penetration or holes, designed with energy-conscious Minnesotans in mind. Solar incentives available. Info at mysolarpod.com.
This is NPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy. It was another interesting week in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar had her best week of the campaign. She came in third behind Senator Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg in the New Hampshire primary. There are still big questions, though, about just how far she can go in this race. I'm joined now by two of our reporters who have been covering the campaign. Brian Baxt is here at the Capitol, and Mark Zdechlik is in the studio downtown. Mark, let me start with you. We talked just a week ago on the radio, and I don't think anybody predicted then that Amy Klobuchar would do as well as she did in New Hampshire, especially after she finished fifth in Iowa the previous week. So what happened other than that debate performance?
Well, I think what happened is that debate performance. That's what I gather from talking to voters and that kind of thing. And she just did very well and impressed a lot of people. There were a lot of people who were undecided going into that primary vote. And the debate left a big impression on her. All along, she's been arguing that she is the most electable of the bunch, making the point that she gets elected gets elected in Minnesota with Democrats, but also independents and some Republicans. And people in New Hampshire bought into that, and she ended up doing better than anyone expected and raising a whole bunch of money. So it was a really, really good showing for her.
And what were you hearing just from ordinary voters when you were in New Hampshire?
Well, it almost sounds like I'm reciting Klobuchar's campaign talking points, but people are saying that she's just reasonable and that she's not bombastic like some other Democrats, Bernie Sanders, for example, who won New Hampshire. Just that they thought that she could stand up to President Trump, and they like her approach to politics.
Brian Baxt, now it's on to Nevada a week from tomorrow. Very different state. What do you think Amy Klobuchar needs to do there?
Well, first of all, she needs to staff up. And Mark had talked about that she's raised a lot of money in the days before and after New Hampshire. She's going to have to put that to use. She immediately went up with a seven-figure ad buy. She had done very little advertising in Nevada prior to that and had very few staff members on the ground. So she's shifting some people out there. This is another one of those caucuses. So it draws the most devoted people, not necessarily like the primary she was just in where people can vote. Decide on a whim to go in, and maybe they're not active partisans, and they still got to vote. So it is a little bit of a tougher dynamic for her. It's a more diverse state. There's a big Latino population, and if the national polling is in any indication, she hasn't really registered much among minority voters in this campaign.
Mike, let me jump in here. I just got off phone with the Klobuchar campaign within the hour. They told me they have 50 people on the ground in Nevada, staffers working there, two offices, one in Reno, one in Las Vegas, and they're looking at the possibility of opening a third office. And they also have staff on the ground in South Carolina, which comes up after the Nevada caucuses. They were unable to tell me exactly how many they have in South Carolina, but they already have a pretty big presence there in Nevada.
There's a debate in Nevada next week, and I would expect that maybe the knives will be out for Amy Klobuchar. Brian, what do you think?
Could be. One of the big factors is whether Michael Bloomberg is also on the stage, and he's someone who hasn't been on any debate stage, and he seems to be creeping up in a lot of these surveys in key states, Super Tuesday states. So it depends on whether he's there, but she's going to get a lot more attention from the rivals than she has to date, because now she's one of the threats to certain people, especially in that moderate lane that she's working in, Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden among them. Elizabeth Warren, you know, she's still plugging away. She might have to differentiate herself from the other woman still in the race as well.
And what about this case of Mayan Burrell? This is a person who was convicted and is serving life in prison for a crime he says he didn't commit. The Associated Press and APM Reports did a big story about that, looking at the evidence, and found a lot of it was pretty questionable. How much of an issue do you think that will be for Amy Klobuchar?
It's in this basket of what she did as a prosecutor. A lot of her campaign message has been about what she's done as a senator, but a lot of people are starting to look at more closely at what she did as a prosecutor because they're worried about whether people were prosecuted more heavily in minority communities in particular. They see that as a potential vulnerability. She's actually called for a new look at the Burrell case, but the Hennepin County Attorney's Office to date has said that that's not going to happen.
And Mark, I have to remind everybody, we're talking about the Democrats because that's where the contest is right now. Bernie Sanders, as you mentioned, came in first in New Hampshire, tied for first, or maybe won the popular vote in Iowa. Is it fair to call Bernie Sanders the front runner for the nomination?
I think it is at this point, but I don't think that it's likely that he's going to be performing as well in Nevada as he performed in New Hampshire, where he is just a regional favorite. He's from the neighboring state. We'll have to wait and see, but I think he, like many of the other candidates, has his work cut out for him going into Nevada. We'll have to see what happens.
And Pete Buttigieg finished ahead of her by far in Iowa and you know, significantly in New Hampshire as well. But does he have any better prospects than she does going forward in this race, or are those two going to be fighting it out now for this sort of more moderate alternative to Sanders?
It looks like that's the case. That's where the battle is. And then you throw Mike Bloomberg into that, and it's this big fight for who's going to be the centrist.
Brian, what do you think?
Yeah, and he's been casting himself as this fresh face on the scene. You know, he's talked about how he's not one with Washington experience, which over the years has been used in a derogatory fashion against senators and other lawmakers with a deep career in Washington. But he's also getting tested and vetted in a lot more deep way since his performance in Iowa and New Hampshire. And that debate last week, he was a frequent target.
Mm-hmm. These primaries are really starting to come fast now. We've got Nevada, then South Carolina, then Super Tuesday, Minnesota, and more than a dozen other states. this is the big question, I guess, for both of you. Do you think Amy Klobuchar is going to be able to hang on through Super Tuesday? Mark?
Let me jump in on that. I think so. Her fundraising is spectacular, relatively speaking, for her. It's nowhere near, you know, what Buttigieg and Sanders have been bringing in, but it's a lot of money, a lot of resources. And she really, at this point, as far as I can tell, has nothing to lose by sticking around and hanging in there and participating in the debates and working voters and getting more attention from folks. So I think that she will absolutely be in for the long haul.
For a lot of these middle-of-the-pack candidates, it's kind of an election-by-election analysis and where they come in. If she starts to fall off the map in Nevada and, you know, doesn't think she's going to do that well in South Carolina, she might think about packing up, because when it comes to Minnesota, you know that she does not want to risk losing the state that she's won every election in so far. Not saying she will, but she's going to be pressed. Bernie Sanders was very popular here in 2016. He's already up on TV. Again, Mike Bloomberg has been up on TV. Amy Klobuchar in these Super Tuesday states hasn't been able to afford to go up on TV. And you've got California and Texas. I mean, very expensive markets. So she's probably going to have to think about, if she doesn't finish top three or so in Nevada, it's probably going to be a time to reevaluate.
And Brian, we are starting to see some of the other campaigns ramping up a little bit here in Minnesota, and President Trump's campaign too, right?
That's right. I mean, President Trump's campaign has had voter drives around the state. They've got some offices. They're spending, they say, tens of millions of dollars on this 2020 campaign. And remember, he didn't spend barely anything last time and still came fairly close. And that was somewhat a product of lower turnout among Democrats and some lower turnout among Republicans and some third party bleed. But he's making it a focus this year. You mentioned that Minnesota is a focus of some of these candidates now. We've already seen 25,000 ballots come in ahead of Minnesota's March 3rd primary. So we could see a strong turnout on March 3rd.
And if very quickly, if you have voted and your candidate drops out, you can pull your ballot back?
As long as you do it within a week of the election. So by the Tuesday before the election, you can do it.
All right, Brian Bax, thanks so much. Mark Zdechlik, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome.
We'll keep an eye on this campaign as it goes on. We'll have a live coverage next Saturday of the Nevada results. And we'll take it from there all the way to Super Tuesday, too. So stick with us here on NPR News. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Mulcahy.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis MPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.